Translation purport by His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami, Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai. Bhishmadev said, "Oh, what terrible sufferings and what terrible injustices you good souls suffer from being the sons of religion personified. You did not deserve to remain alive under those tribulations, yet you were protected by the Brahmanas, God, and religion." Purport. Maharaj Yudhishthira was disturbed due to the great massacre in the Battle of Kurukshetra. Bhishmadev could understand this, and therefore he spoke first of the terrible sufferings of Maharaj Yudhishthira. He was put into difficulty by injustice only, and the Battle of Kurukshetra was fought just to counteract this injustice. Therefore, he should not regret the great massacre. He wanted to point out particularly that they were always protected by the Brahmanas, the Lord, and religious principles. As long as they were protected by these three important items, there was no cause of disappointment. Thus, Bhishmadev encouraged Maharaj Yudhishthira to dissipate his despondency. As long as a person is fully in cooperation with the wishes of the Lord, guided by the bona fide Brahmanas and Vaishnavas, and strictly following religious principles, one has no cause for despondency, however trying the circumstances of life. Bhishmadev, as one of the authorities in the line, wanted to impress this point upon the Pandavas. Aho kashtam aho nyayam yat yuyam dharmanandana jivitum narata klishtam vipra dharma chutashaya. Bhishmadev said, "Oh, what terrible sufferings and what terrible injustices you good souls suffer from being the sons of religion personified. You did not deserve to remain alive under those tribulations, yet you were protected by the Brahmanas, God, and religion." This is quite famous verse of Srimad Bhagavatam, because this is the beginning of Bhishmadev's instructions on Dharma, spoken to Maharaj Yudhishthira. And as we were mentioning yesterday, the words of a dying man are normally attracting everyone's attention, right? That there was even some kind of poll, what the people say at the moment of death, right? What are the last words of the dying people? And funny enough, the most popular word, the most popular last word of a dying man, as it was noted during the wartime, like someone's, you know, terminally injured at the battlefield, and before death they say their last word, and the last word is "Mommy." So, and they go back to mommy. Of course, in order to go back to Krishna, you have to say Krishna. And it's pretty common. We might say, oh, this might be the feature of Kali Yuga. No, it's always been like that. If you look at the Hari Bhakti Shuddha Doi, it's very interesting scripture, part of Naradiya Purana, Prabhupada referred to many times in his preaching. And more elaborate a description of the Nrsinga Lila is given there. You know, some part of Nrsinga Lila is described there by Narad Muni. And he explains how what was exactly happening when Hiranyakashipu was leaving his body, when Nrsingadev started tearing him apart, and it became pretty obvious for Hiranyakashipu that that's the end of his story, before he was foolishly hoping to defeat Nrsingadev. But after, you know, he finally came to his senses and realized that that's it. Nrsingadev is gonna kill him now. And he started shouting. And what he started shouting? Mommy, mommy, mommy! Just imagine such a great hero conquering all the demigods and suddenly calling out to his mommy. And yeah, if you don't take my word for it, look at Hari Bhakti Shodadaya. This is what Shastra says. Hiranyakashipu was calling for mummy. And Prahlad Maharaj was standing nearby. And Prahlad Maharaj was always very humble. But at this point, he lost his composure and he actually started telling Hiranyakashipu, "You fool! Why are you calling for mummy? You should be chanting Govinda, 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 Govinda." So he was chanting the holy name for his father, who was not capable of doing so, but thus benefiting him spiritually. So anyway, it's just an example that, you know, the last words, and especially the very last word, are always catching people's attention. You know, what is it that people say at the end of their lives? And so this is very significant. In here, the Bhishma Dev is lying on the bed of arrows, and it's pretty clear this is the dying man. And what would the dying man say? And actually, it's interesting that, as we know, he was capable of, you know, maintaining his life as long as he wanted to, and could die at his will. And therefore, he actually stayed, even though his body was pretty much finished, but he stayed in the body waiting for the best time, and actually didn't want to leave before he would see Krishna like that. And so, just to fulfill his desire, the Supreme Lord, along with the Pandavas, they appear in front of Bhishma Dev. And of course, they are very much aggrieved because Bhishma Dev took such a nice care of them and was protecting and raising them, etc. I mean, he raised three generations personally, right? He raised Pandavas' grandparents, his parents, and Pandavas as well. So, and naturally, he had a lot of affection for Pandavas. And so Pandavas were very much aggrieved to see his condition. And what were the very first words Bhishma Dev said? "Aho kashtam ahonyayam." You know, his first words were, "Oh, what terrible sufferings!" And naturally, you know, we would expect, okay, someone is in such a terrible condition, he would say, "Oh, how terrible suffering I'm undergoing!" Right? "Ahonyayam," what terrible injustice! You could think, okay, he was referring to himself. No, he was not referring to himself. He says, "Yatyuyam," I'm talking about you. What terrible sufferings you going through. And this is, I mean, you know, as we understand from the end of the previous chapter, Maharaj Yudhishthir was in this mental agony. Oh, so many people died because of me, 640 million, etc. So he was suffering a great deal. And, you know, it's kind of shock to see the man in such a state, in such a miserable state. And then he says, poor you. Right? It's hard for us to imagine, because battles and all this is so far removed from our experience. But just imagine someone being run over by some truck and lying on the ground, bleeding, all the bones broken, and you run towards that person to help, and then you trip and fall and you scratch your elbow, for example. Right, and this man says, oh, poor you, you scratched your elbow. What happened to you? Right. So that would be quite a shock, right? But why worry about the elbow? You're dying, man. But this is the mentality of the Vaishnavas, that they don't care about their troubles. And they only care about how to relieve others from trouble. This is really amazing. And Bhishma Dev, of course, Mahajan, one of the greatest authorities amongst the Vaishnavas on universal scale, he's showing that example, that he doesn't care about himself, never complains, you know, about his position. And he's only worried about others. So this is Vaishnava para dukkha dukkhi, that one who is very much concerned with the troubles other people going through. So he's very compassionate, very empathic. And so we can see Maharaj Yudhishthir also so empathic. So he's thinking about, not about his victory and all the joys, but he's thinking about the sufferings and sorrows of other people who had to give up their bodies in the battle. And as Prabhupada explains, this sorrow was kind of bodily grief, which he should not be having as a Vaishnava. But he was absorbed in this illusion because Krishna wanted Bhishma Dev to dispel that illusion, and because Krishna wanted everyone to know the glories of Bhishma Dev. And funny enough, Krishna himself tried to console Maharaj Yudhishthir to no avail. Maharaj Yudhishthir was not pacified by Krishna's words. And of course, Krishna, you know, externally, as it is described, externally he was trying to convince Maharaj Yudhishthir that he should not lament, but from within the heart, he was preventing him. And this was the plan, just to reveal the glories of Bhishma Dev. What kind of amazing devotee is Bhishma Dev. Even though he was fighting on the wrong side. But it's amazing that his body was on the side of the demons, but his heart was on the side of the devotees and Krishna. So that's a very powerful lesson from Bhagavatam, which actually repeated many, many times. Like Vritrasura story is another powerful example. It's not so important where your body is. What is important where your heart is, right? It's like devotee's joke. It's better to be in the bed thinking about Bhagavatam than be in the Bhagavatam and thinking about bed, right? Some devotees can nicely combine these two. There are rumors that, you know, like people can be educated in sleep. And so I think some devotees is trying to check if this is true or not during Bhagavatam classes. But yeah, it's important, you know, where our heart is. Because after all, this movement is called Krishna consciousness. You know, Prabhupada didn't give it any religious name, you know, temple of Krishna or something like that. Krishna consciousness or Krishna religion. No, Krishna consciousness. And so the last words of a dying man are the most important words. And Bhishma Dev is revealing two things in this chapter. One is glories of the Lord, and the other one is our duties in the service of the Lord. And he himself is a perfect example of sticking to Dharma and doing that for the sake of pleasing the Lord, amazingly enough, fighting against Krishna, shooting arrows at Krishna. And it's all done for Krishna's pleasure. And Krishna was enjoying that. It's quite amazing. And, you know, all these descriptions are given to help us understand that Krishna consciousness is not black and white. Right? And sometimes, yeah, we tend to try to, you know, put everything in boxes, etc. No. You cannot put Krishna in box. I mean, sometimes devotees put deity of Krishna in the box. But it doesn't mean that you can put Krishna in the box, right? Yeah, Krishna is a free spirit. He can do whatever he wants. And so, we can reflect on the power of the last words of a dying Vaishnava. I was thinking very important, interesting example. His Holiness Bhaktivedanta Maharaj, when he was about to leave his body, and His Holiness Radhanath Maharaj was in his association, and yeah, he kind of put on hold all of his, you know, high profile engagements just to be with his dear godbrother at the last moments of his life, at the last days of his life. And interestingly enough, Bhaktivedanta Maharaj, he, instead of, you know, thinking about himself, he was discussing with Radhanath Maharaj, and basically he was asking Radhanath Maharaj the details, how he joined the movement, etc. You know, they had a good association at these last days. And Radhanath Maharaj described his story, how he joined the movement, to Bhaktivedanta Maharaj. And so Bhaktivedanta Maharaj said, "This is such an amazing story. You should write a book about it." But, you know, naturally devotees are very shy to promote themselves. And it's kind of etiquette that devotee doesn't write his own biography. Somebody else should do that, etc. And so Radhanath Maharaj was very reluctant. He said, no, what? Why should I bother? But Bhaktivedanta Maharaj insisted. He said, no, this is such an amazing story. It's not your story. It's actually Krishna's story, because Krishna is so much involved in it. And so you should share it with the world for everyone's benefit. And Radhanath Maharaj was still reluctant. And then Bhaktivedanta Maharaj, because he was a little bit more senior, right? That he got sannyas in 79 and Radhanath Maharaj, I think, in 82, a few years later. So he used that as a leverage. He said, no, actually, I'm a dying man, and I want you to promise me that you will write this book. That's my only request and my wish, you know, and you should respect the wish of a dying man. And he basically pushed Radhanath Maharaj to do that. And he left this world. And amazingly enough, you know, after writing this book and after this book became distributed, Radhanath Maharaj suddenly, you know, got opportunities to do such a high-level preaching to the, you know, ministers, to the prime ministers of the countries, to the president of the United States, to the House of, in the House of Lords, House of Parliaments, etc. And we know this is what Bhakti Tirtha Maharaj was doing in his life, right? So, interestingly enough, he kind of passed the baton unto him. And so, and of course, this is something Srila Prabhupada really wanted to be happening, and we're very lucky that Srila Radhanath Maharaj is doing that. But we can see this is the power of the words of a dying man. How much power is there? Immense power. And so, this is why it's really important for us. And of course, Srila Prabhupada, his final instructions, and there is one final instruction which is very, very famous and everybody knows about it. Jai Shri Shri Radha Gokulananda, Shri Shri Sitaram Lakshmananman, Shri Shri Gaur Nitai Ki Jai. And what was that final instruction? Or one of the final instructions? Huh? Yes, he said, if you want to please me, then you should cooperate with each other, right? And pretty much everybody knows it because it's such a powerful instruction, and especially because it's something we're still working on. It's something which is still very, you know, big time work in progress. But not only that, anyone knows the circumstances in which Prabhupada made that statement? Anyone? Anyone wants to know what were the exact circumstances Prabhupada made this statement under? Actually, one younger disciple came to him and he said, Srila Prabhupada, I feel so much pain by seeing your condition, and especially that, you know, we are losing you, and so if it is at all possible, you know, there is a description in Bhagavatam how Maharaj Yayati exchanged his old age for the youth of his son, Puru. And so he said, if it is at all possible, I would love to give you my health and longevity in exchange for your old age, illness, and death. So just to, you know, I would give you my life, and I would die in your place if it is possible. And Prabhupada really appreciated the sentiment, and he said, yes, that I can see that you're making this offering out of love for me. But then he said that famous statement, but your real love for me would be shown by how much you cooperate with each other, which is a kind of subtle indication that for some devotees, it's easier to die than cooperate with each other. Because dying means physical body is dying, right? But to work with each other, false ego has to die. And that's much, much greater challenge, right? And so, But Srila Prabhupada was really emphatic about it, and we can see that from the first purpose of ISKCON. So Srila Prabhupada started with that, real unity and peace in the world. He wanted real unity and peace in the world through introducing Krishna consciousness, and he wanted devotees to be united in the service as well. And it's kind of connected to yesterday's topic, but before we touch on that, we'll come back to what is explained in here, because it's very amazing. You know, Bhishma Dev and Yudhishthir, both of them, are exactly on the same page. They are not lamenting about themselves. Yudhishthir Maharaj went through so many hardships, as we know, along with all the Pandavas, and fighting and being injured at the battlefield. He didn't care about all these things. And Bhishma Dev, you know, lying on the deathbed of arrows and suffering great bodily discomfort, to say the least, he doesn't care about this, right? What they care about? Benefits of others. And actually, the pain and tribulations Bhishma Dev refers to is inability to perform dharma, that they were actually barred from properly executing their service for the Supreme Lord. And that is the greatest pain. That is the greatest pain of a devotee, when he is barred, when he is obstructed in serving the Lord. And serving not just the Lord, but serving Vaishnavas. And the greatest joy of a devotee is to have an opportunity to serve Vaishnavas and benefit others, not just Vaishnavas, but serve others and help others to become Krishna conscious. And this is what they are actually discussing here. And that's why... And Bhishma Dev says, yes, that it was a terrible injustice that you were prevented from doing your service, and you had to suffer and fight for the right to continue with your services, but now it's all done. Now you have this opportunity, that he will say in future. And all the troubles were actually done according to the plan of the Lord, because he says, as Prabhupada mentions here, the conclusion of this, of his statement, is the most important. Vipra dharmachyutashraya, that you were always under the shelter of Brahmanas, of Dharma, and Achyuta, the Supreme Lord. Ashraya means shelter, right? So you were always sheltered. That means everything was going in the right way, and all these troubles you had to go through were part of the Lord's plan. And so this is what Krishna consciousness means, that in devotional service, Krishna consciousness means Ananda Maya Abhyasat. Srila Prabhupada said one time, devotee is always happy in Krishna consciousness, and devotee is never morose. So if someone is morose, Srila Prabhupada said, that means this devotee is in Maya. Simple definition. Or on at one morning walk, he said something even more shocking. He said, the devotee never suffers. Devotee means one is never suffering. And one disciple got confused, and he was asking Srila Prabhupada, but what if devotees or if we still see devotees suffering. And Prabhupada said, that means this person is not a devotee. Because devotee doesn't suffer. And so that helps us to kind of understand what does it mean to be a devotee. Because sometimes, you know, we might come across the passages in Prabhupada's books glorifying who devotees are, etc., that devotees are the best people, etc., etc., higher than brahmanas, higher than anyone. And then we think, okay, yes, I'm chanting Hare Krishna, I'm worshipping Krishna, I'm also the devotee. But then suddenly, after that, we read, devotee means one who always remembers Krishna and never forgets him for one moment in his life. We think, okay, I don't really fit into that one. So we can understand that we are practicing Krishna consciousness. We are not yet Krishna conscious, right? That's why it's work in progress kind of thing. But the only opportunity for us to advance in Krishna consciousness is Vipradharma Chutashaya, the shelter of Brahmanas, Dharma, and the Supreme Lord Achyuta. And interestingly enough, Vipra, Brahmanas are mentioned first. Meaning those who have knowledge and experience, and we can understand that it refers to senior and more mature Vaishnavas in Krishna consciousness, right? And how do you understand the seniority of Vaishnava? Of course, there are so many external factors, right? Age, position in the society, etc., etc. But the ultimate seniority is how much Krishna consciousness one has. And how do we understand the level of Krishna consciousness? The ultimate symptom is humility. So we can understand, the more one is humble, the more senior one is spiritually, right? And humble means not necessarily kind of declaring one's glories to the world. And that's why it's really easy to miss who is really advanced devotee and who is not. If we judge externally by positions, etc., because a devotee who is genuinely Krishna conscious and humble may not really strive for position, or even if the position is offered, devotee might not even genuinely feel himself qualified. But that humility actually makes one the best candidate in devotional service. Well, the best of all the devotees. And so, and humility, interesting definition Radhanath Maharaj gives. Humility does not think to think of himself less, but to think less of himself, right? Humble person doesn't mean that I'm thinking I'm something, you know, like very low. I'm just not thinking about myself, right? I'm thinking about others. And how can I benefit others? How can I help others to become Krishna conscious? That's real humility. And how can I make sure that devotees are happy in their Krishna consciousness, right? So if devotees are happy in Krishna consciousness, that is the source of my happiness. And if devotees do not look happy, that should be, you know, the cause of my anxiety. What is happening? Why devotees are not happy? And sometimes you can look at the devotees and think, you know, what's going on? Because it says in Garuda Purana, I think, that there are different offenses towards Vaishnavas. And of course, Vaishnava Aparad is the worst offense. And of course, it starts with the worst, trying to kill Vaishnava, or injure Vaishnava, or blaspheme Vaishnava, or speak ill about Vaishnava behind the back. The famous gossip we've mentioned. It's also Vaishnava Aparad. And the last on the list of the offenses is not to feel happy upon seeing a Vaishnava. And Garuda Purana says, if anyone commits any of the above offenses towards Vaishnava, one goes to hell. Clear and simple. We might not think like that. Oh, I don't, you know, show any happiness upon seeing a devotee. I will go to hell for that. But this is what Garuda Purana says. And so sometimes you're in the association of devotees and you think, okay, that devotees don't even look at me, or if they look at me, they give me such a look as if I've done something wrong towards them. And I'm thinking, okay, I'm not a good devotee. That's understandable that devotees are not very happy to see me. That's fine. But if I see this is how they treat others as well. So devotees don't even look at each other, right? They just pass by each other as if, you know, they don't know each other at all. As if these are strangers on the street. What to speak of smiling at each other? What to speak of giving little time to each other, right? And you think, what's wrong with the picture? We're supposed to, you know, Krishna consciousness supposed to be making us a little bit more happy. Not just a little bit more happy. It's supposed to give us anandam buddhi vardhanam, susukham kartum avyayam, supposed to, you know, make us full of joy. Right? And then, if that's the case, then we wouldn't even have to, like, make a lot of effort to attract people to Krishna consciousness, because everybody is attracted to happy people, right? Everybody wants to be happy. But if people see, okay, this is a miserable society, miserable club, then who wants to join? Who is going to be interested in that? And so I was wondering that I remember, you know, doing Harinam, and, you know, I passed by one lady, and of course we're so happy when we chant the holy name. And this lady just, and you expect people to respond in a positive way to Harinam, but she looked at me very sternly and she said, you only pretending to be happy. And she passed by. And I was thinking, why she is making this comment? You know, that aren't we genuinely happy? Yes, we are. But probably he had an experience beyond Harinam with the devotees. And so probably she knows what she's saying, you know, like she knows what she's talking about. And so, yes, I think it should be a matter of concern for us, what's wrong with the picture, and what can we do to help the devotees to feel genuinely happy in Krishna consciousness, and maybe actually do it. And of course, there are many reasons I could think of, and I'm sure you could think of many reasons why, what are the details missing in the picture. But yeah, somehow I remembered one episode, actually, in my, you know, life, I had quite a number of interfaith exchanges. Some of them were official, some of them were just casual. And so this was one casual interfaith exchange. I was in Durban, South Africa, and it was before Rath Yatra. And there were so many devotees preparing for the festival, and everyone was super busy, and suddenly two Mormon preachers come to the reception, and I was there by chance, and the receptionist tells me, "We're so busy, would you please talk to these boys, to this young man?" And I'm thinking, okay, they came to preach to us, to kind of deliver the holy message. Okay, I'll talk to them. And so I'm prepared for this philosophical discussion with them, and I'm saying, okay, thank you for coming. What can I do for you? And they're telling me, we came to do service. And I just couldn't believe my ears. I said, what service? And they said, well, this is our standard, that wherever big social functions are happening, we are coming and offering our services. And I said, what do you mean? What would you like to do? Because, you know, like, I don't think we'll be able to offer you some high level, you know, high profile services. They said, no, it's fine. We're ready to do anything. I said, really? Like, our congregation, for example, is, you know, peeling and cutting vegetables for the feast. So what, do you mean that you would be sitting and peeling and cutting vegetables with others? And they said, yeah, we'll be happy to do that. Just, you know, show us where to go and whom we can contact, who can engage us, and we'll do the service. I showed them, and, you know, it was so many years ago, it just stuck in my mind. My God, you know, it's like, what an example of selfless service attitude. And I was thinking about ourselves, you know. I mean, what to speak of having such standards in our society. Even this opportunity would arise, you know, what are the first thoughts crossing the devotees' minds? Oh, these materialistic people, why should I serve, you know, support their sense gratification, let them go to hell unless they chant Hare Krishna, right? So that's an interesting when you see examples of other people following Dharma the way we do not do, and you think, well, maybe something's missing in our consciousness. And the other example actually was here. I was distributing books near the Nizden Swaminarayan temple. And I saw one Gujarati boy. I offered him Krishna book. He was very happy. He said, wow, this is amazing, Krishna book. I was looking for one for so long. And I said, yeah, please take it and give whatever donation you can. And he said, unfortunately, I just came from Gujarat and I have absolutely no money. I couldn't give you anything. But if I see you next time, you know, I'll make little money, and I definitely want to buy Krishna book. you know, because I would feel bad taking this book off you for free and not giving you anything. You know, Gujaratis have culture. And I said, where are you going? And he said, I'm going to the temple, Swaminarayan temple. And, you know, what is coming to our minds when someone says, I'm going to the temple, some congregation member? Two reasons to go to the temple, right? It's either some VIP person giving classes or some kirtans, or maybe it's a big festival like Janmashtami or whatever. These are the main reasons people go to the temple. So I'm asking, is it festival or someone special visiting temple you're going to attend some program? He said, no, there are no programs there. I just arrived. And our system is that upon arrival, we go to the temple, and they have committees there at the temple. They provide us with initial money. They give us money to start, and they give us, you know, they get us job, and they give us, you know, helping us with the accommodation and whatever else is needed. So, and I'm thinking, wow, that's amazing. And before that, I visited the temple, and it's really spectacular. I mean, you know, they have a huge restaurant, and you go there, and whatever is on the menu you can take, and it's all for free. Free restaurant, full-fledged. And so many other things. And it's very opulent. And I'm thinking, how do they manage? And then we went and we saw the video, you know, a short documentary explaining the history of the temple. And basically it's amazing that they just carved different details of the temple in different parts of India and Italy. And they, you know, shipped all these details, and they basically, you know, put it all together as a Lego constructor or something, you know. In 11 months, they put the whole temple up, and temple is just mind-blowing. You know, snow-white marble outside and beautiful green Italian marble inside with intrinsic, you know, wood carving and everything. Just piece of art. And it was just a short, maybe 5-6 second episode in that documentary. You know, the voice behind the screen was saying that the whole congregation very actively took part in fundraising. And they show one guy pushing a trolley full of, you know, packs with banknotes. And two other standing with, you know, like bank bags, sorting out the packs according to nominations. And that blew my mind. I mean, they're so, you know, they have so much funding, where it's coming from. And when I spoke to this boy, I realized where it's coming from. That this is how they look after their people. Someone comes, and whatever one needs for one's life, they immediately provide. And so they just focused on serving each other so much. And it's selfless. They don't expect, they don't demand anything. They just give and give and give. And so people who come and, you know, brought up in this culture, it's like two things. Serving and giving, serving and giving, and nothing else. And everybody does only that, serving each other and giving to each other. And being brought up in this culture, people know nothing else. They give everything and they serve everyone. And I was thinking, you know, we still have some room for improvement in that regard as well. And if we, you know, look at the Dharma at how other people follow the Dharma, maybe we could improve, and maybe we could have a little bit more enthusiastic and happy devotees in our ranks as well, which I believe is one very important purpose of this movement, making devotees happy in Krishna consciousness. All right, so these were few thoughts I wanted to share.